This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for joining us. Jill McCorkle's new novel, Hieroglyphics, delves into history and memory set in her native North Carolina. On Tuesday, Jill will participate in a virtual interview as part of Focus Lit, the fundraiser for Southern Lit Alliance here in Chattanooga. Steve Yarbrough, a friend of Jill's and a member of the Fellowship of Southern Writers, will interview her. I spoke with Jill, who was in Hillsboro, North Carolina, and Linda Levan, Executive Director of Southern Lit Alliance. Linda, Jill, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks so much for having us.
Yes, great to be here.
Jill, you are in North Carolina. Tell us more about how you got into writing.
Oh, I have written for as long as I can remember. My earliest memories of writing and loving to make up stories, I was five. But I didn't really start writing seriously until I was in college and taking creative writing classes. That was it. I was hooked.
You have written short stories and you have written novels. How would you describe the themes that you have explored in all that you've written over the years?
Probably a lot of writers feel this way. Sometimes I feel like I write the same story over and over. And I know it's different each time, but I began writing, you know, early, and I'm now about to turn 63. And so I look back over the course of my work and I see a lot of overlapping themes. I write a lot about kind of domestic situations, relationships between various family members. I think I write a lot about people getting those second chances in life. Our society has become so much about win, win, win. And I'm one of those people who happens to believe that failure, just enough failure, can be a very good thing along the way. And that, in fact, many of those turns and moments are what shape us. It's what we write about. Otherwise, we'd be writing these cheerful books that sound like those Christmas cards where everybody brags and everything is fabulous. So I'm very interested in the places where the road takes a turn. I'm interested in memory and what we do with the past as we continue to move forward.
Hieroglyphics is about that turn in the road. It is about memory through the story of Lil and Frank.
Yes. They are a couple in the home stretch of life. Both of them dealt with an early childhood loss. They each lost a parent. And in many ways, those early losses are what brought them together as a couple, because they had both grown up so quickly. And their whole lives have been defined by that early loss and trying to make sense of what they don't know. Her mother went out one night without saying where and was at the Coconut Grove nightclub in Boston, which famously horrific fire that night. And then his father was on a train on his way home from the war and a catastrophic crash. And these two events were real historical events that happened almost exactly a year apart. One in my native county, North Carolina, the train wreck, and then the Boston fire. And I lived in the Boston area for 20 years. So I had been drawn to both events and the details surrounding them for a very long time, but had not really thought of doing fiction around it, except it did seem to work as the backdrop for a novel.
And then there's another character in the novel whose life triggers these memories when it comes to Lil and Frank, and that would be Shelley.
Yes. And Shelley is a fun kind of character to have. She's had a very difficult life and is kind of at the end of her road raising her six-year-old son. Shelley's just one of those characters who starts talking and doesn't stop. So she's very easy to hand off to on the page, because I feel like she's running from her past. And as a result, her thoughts are often running in one direction or another. So as a writer, it was a lot of fun to deal with her character and her son, Harvey, as well. I've often told my students that I love working with characters at either end of the age spectrum because they're without a filter. You know, the old guys, the filter has worn out and is no longer present. And with the kids, it hasn't developed yet. They just don't know any better. And there's something so wonderfully liberating to allow someone to think something and have it come right off the tongue.
And there's something so strikingly similar in how the lack of the filter sounds on either end of that scale.
Well, it is. And they do have a lot of overlap in subject matter sometimes. I do think humans come full circle if lucky enough to live that long.
How did you arrive at the title Hieroglyphics?
You know, I was thinking a lot about what actually gets lost from our lives. My dad died almost 30 years ago, or soon will be. My mother has dementia and has for a decade. And so just in going back over their things, there are many things you understand, but then you'll find a little note or a scrap and you're not quite sure what it means. And so I've been aware, looking around, taking stock of my own mementos. And, you know, I'll write a note myself and the next day have no idea what it means. And it's like I'm staring at some foreign language because I wrote it too quickly. But I was just thinking of how many parts of our lives don't translate to the next generation. You know, if we don't explain it, if we don't put it into words, you know, we all as individuals have things we wish we had said, we wish we had done. Nobody knows those things. And so to explore the interior life of a character and get to catalog and register those emotions and also to look at the various scraps. At one point, Lil, who's going back through all of her notes and journals, finds a receipt that on any other ordinary day, you know, it would have gone right in the trash. But for some reason, it didn't go in the trash. And now here she is with this receipt and she can look at it. And it was an ordinary day where she had bought both baby food and the kind of shaving cream her father used. So suddenly that little scrap of paper represents a whole stretch of time in her life when she was a young woman running between parent and child, you know, in those very harried years. And so there are a lot of references to moments like that, those scraps of time that if we could reach back and grab a few, we would do it in a minute, but they're so easily lost.
What you're talking about is a condensed symbol, something that doesn't have much significance in real time. Then it's lost, then it reappears. And because of everything that was happening around it, it takes on such a greater significance and can even unlock the ability to recover history, recover memory, or view those things from other angles.
Absolutely. You just answered it so much better than I did. I really appreciate that. I was thinking a lot about actual language. You know, so I was thinking about kids with their decoder rings and all kinds of symbols and translations in our lives, but also the way that objects take on meaning, you know, the way that we collect souvenirs. So I had not prepared for the growth around some of the objects and things in their lives, but it made total sense because I think what has always both intrigued me and I find absolutely heartbreaking is when you read about either of those tragic events, eventually you come to these long cataloged lists of how people were identified. And it was in the tiniest, often most intimate way, you know, something inscribed in a ring or maybe a particular kind of cufflink or a shoe or a dry cleaning tag and a coat, things, you know, you didn't necessarily think of when you got up and put in your pocket. And so the objects, in the same way, these sort of decoding the language, those objects told the story of a whole life.
And Linda, what Jill writes about, what Jill talks about here, this is human nature. This is the stuff that literature is made of. And it has a particular expression when we talk about Southern literature.
Yeah, the characters. I think it all comes down to the characters and how we identify with them and their memories and their lives and think about our own parallel.
For this event that is coming up, Jill will be joined by someone.
Yeah, Jill's been so gracious to do this. And we have Steve Yarborough, who is also a great author, who is a part of the Fellowship of Southern Writers, is going to be interviewing her. He's a friend of Jill's and familiar with hieroglyphics. And so it's always more fun to have two authors and hearing them converse than just hearing me flap my gums. So I'll let someone else do that this time.
Steve and I have talked together for years at Swanee. I'm excited to get to see him as well.
So this is a fundraiser for Southern Lit. It's been a difficult year not being able to have our Southward Literature Festival, but we have really found some silver linings and some of our programming and have been able to do a whole lot by Zoom that we never dreamed we could do. Writing workshops, we still have author presentations. So much of our programming we've been able to continue, and fundraising and getting that support is of course required to make all that happen. And our plans for next year, when hopefully we will be bringing in-person events back, doing some planning now.
And meantime, beyond the fundraiser, you have a few things going on during the summer.
Yeah, so we're in the works of planning with Christian Collier, who is a spoken word poet in Chattanooga that a lot of people are familiar with. He is going to be doing, performing, I like to say, his work at Sculpture Fields. So we're looking at doing that on July the 15th. And then we have the Yahoo Fest, which is Young Adult Genre Festival, which will be in September. That will be virtual. And so that is next on the books, as well as some plans for some other authors to come back.
And if people want more information about this talk with Jill and with Steve and Southern Lit Alliance, where can people go online?
Southernlitalliance.org. There are links right there on the main page, as well as some information about the programs that this event will support.
And if you can't sign up for the event, but you want to give, that's the site that you go to.
That would be most welcome. Very appreciated.
All right, Linda, Jill, thanks so much.
Thanks, Red.
Thank you.
The Chattanooga Writers Guild is now accepting submissions for its annual spring writing contest. The deadline is June 15th, and winners will be announced on July 15th. Ray Zimmerman is the Guild's president, and Kate Landers is a board member.
Ray, Kate, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Tell us more about the contest.
Well, we're very excited to offer this contest. It's a multi-year event. We do this every spring or summer, I should say. And it is open to our members, of course, but anyone else within a 70-mile radius of Chattanooga. There is a membership fee, but it's minimal, and we use that just to offset the cost of the prizes. There are cash prizes in each category, $100 for first place, and it declines from that for second and third.
And among the requirements for people who submit their work, they must never have been published before except on their own blog. And of course, their work must be their work. It must be original.
Yeah, that refers to the work that they submit. It's okay if they've published other works, but the work that they're submitting to this contest cannot have been previously published. And that's just to prevent confusion with copyright issues. We don't want to award somebody an award and print their story in the prize booklet and then have somebody say, wait a minute, that's copywritten work. So in order to avoid that kind of issue, we insist on nothing that's previously published except on their own blog. That also increases the chances that a judge will not have seen the work before. because if they have, they have to recuse themselves, and then we have to find another judge for that category, or else we have to throw out the work.
And speaking of categories, we have fiction, creative nonfiction, poetry, and a new category, creative culinary creation. Where did that come from?
Well, last year was the first year that we tried to throw in a fourth category that was focused on Chattanooga. If you had a story or a poem about Chattanooga, we asked that you submit it. And this year we wanted to continue that fourth category, but switch things up. And actually, I really like cooking and incorporating food into stories and sharing recipes. So I asked the other board members how they would feel about this fourth category. And everybody seemed really excited. And our judge for that category, John C. Minoni, also really enjoys cooking. And he has an Italian heritage that he likes to share with his works or talking about food. So he agreed to be our judge. And that's very exciting.
And I see that people are invited to submit a complimentary recipe with their food-related story or poem, but also recipes will not be part of the judging process.
Correct. Yeah, it's okay if it's not, you don't have to be a chef to submit, but just, you know, I think everybody has a recipe or several recipes that they really enjoy sharing with people. And this was just a fun way to do it. So there will be some recipes from the Chattanooga Writers Guild included in the book, hopefully, in our anthology.
And this contest comes after more than a year of the pandemic. Who knows how that may influence the submissions that you will receive?
Could be that people have gotten very creative to cope with isolation. And it could be that they've decided to forget about writing. I don't know. Some people in each category, I would guess. You know, I also love to cook, but I cannot submit anything to this contest since I'm the contest coordinator. I'm glad we offer this opportunity to the writers and to the community because it just gives them a chance to shine, gives them a chance to show us their best work, possibly win a cash prize, possibly get published in our anthology. And the anthologies, as long as we have copies, we continue to sell them. So we are selling for 2 or 3 years at this point. Last year's anthology is also available on Amazon. So people can get copies to see what the judges have liked in past years. But those people aren't necessarily judging this year. There are three judges in each category, two preliminary judges. And the story or poem that they give the highest rating to will move up and be evaluated by the final judge for that category.
And we are in the early bird submission period. Contest closes June 15th. Winners will be announced July 15th. What else is going on with the Chattanooga Writers Guild beyond the contest as we look into the summer and the fall?
We have workshops every month right now. In June, there will be a workshop on fiction, and we've had several workshops because we don't have in-person meetings. We've had these workshops going. We have had programs monthly on the second Tuesday of the month, which is our normal meeting time. We've had recorded programs going on our Facebook page. Those were recorded by Mark Anderson, and he interviewed the members of each of our little writing groups, because we do have writing groups that meet monthly. There's one for creative nonfiction and poetry. There's one for just poetry. There's a fiction group that meets out in Hickson. But of course, all of these are meeting online right now. And we're all anxious to get back to in-person meetings. Our May meeting was a picnic, so we did have an in-person meeting for the month of May. And we're looking at probably going to those in-person meetings for the summer.
And where can people go online to submit their work for the contest and keep up on everything with the Chattanooga Writers Guild?
ChattanoogaWritersGuild.org.
All right. Ray, Kate, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Scenic Roots. More in a moment.
This is Scenic Roots talking writing. Our guest is Kate Doty, a writer who spent 15 years writing for the New York Times. For much of that time, she worked on the wedding desk. Her book about the experience, Mergers and Acquisitions, as the title suggests, is a clear-eyed and unsentimental look at marriage, while at the same time, it's a love letter to New York and a droll account of her own experiences in finding a partner. This is an excerpt from the audio version of the book, read by Dorothy Dillingham Blue.
The manila folder was slapped down on my desk with a flick of a large, hairy wrist, snapping me out of my daydream. My editor, Ira, stared down at me from above his mustache, standing with crossed arms as I scanned what he'd thrown down. I felt like Deep Throat was waiting for me in a parking deck somewhere. "Think you can handle him?" he said, raising his eyebrows and looking down at the folder. "He's a pretty well-known ass, not just your average politician jerk." I was 24, writing for the New York Times and convinced of my invincibility. "Of course I can," I said, and snorted. "He's just a person."
"Yeah, but he doesn't believe that," Ira said. "You let me know if you need backup."
That was Monday. Then came Wednesday. I was about 2 minutes into the call with the pretty well-known ass when he interrupted me, confirming his reputation. "How dare you ask me that?" he snapped. "My relationship with my future wife is none of your business."
"I'm sorry, sir," I said, as gently as I could. "But we ask these questions of everyone, even well-known people like yourself who need no introduction. It's part of the Times' fact-checking process." I could have added, but I didn't, that he was making his relationship part of my business. This was a man who, after all, had called a press conference to trumpet his love for his last girlfriend, whom he also said he'd planned to marry, but she ended it before he had the chance.
Suzanne, his publicist, sighed. She was listening in on the conference line, of course, likely to protect me as much as the apoplectic man on the phone. The retired senior senator from the great state of New York was marrying a woman 3 decades his junior, a news item that had already been detailed breathlessly by the city's gossip columnists. His bride-to-be was a political operative and had spent a few years at City Hall, so she knew from us. I think that must have been her type. She and the senator had met at a Republican fundraiser and soon afterwards started showing up arm in arm at establishment restaurants, at more fundraisers, and on Donald Trump's private plane. He even attended her intramural soccer matches out on Long Island and started calling himself a soccer dad, although there's no way he remembered his turn to bring snacks for the team. This went on for a couple of years and all seemed blissful. Or if not blissful, then adequate enough to establish them as the city's newest political power couple. He finally asked her to marry him at her 37th birthday party, slapping a 4-carat diamond ring on top of her cake, thereby making a celebration of her all about him. The affair was set for the first weekend in May. They booked a Catholic church on Long Island, registered at Tiffany's, and, presumably, wrote up one hell of a prenup. After the nuptials, Ms. Smooth Operative was to be known as Mrs. Senator.
"I don't have to answer these fucking questions from you or anyone fucking else," the senator railed down the line. "You should already know these things about me, fuck you."
I heard the click of someone exiting the conference call. His flack sighed again.
"Kate," she said wearily, "could we answer your questions via email?"
I felt badly for this poor woman, who probably made 3 times what I did, but there was no way it could have been worth it. Spending 7 days a week working the phones, protecting a craven, attention-hungry man from his nastiest impulses, drafting non-apology after non-apology, and fielding calls from reporters when he succumbed to them. And that was for political matters. But this, only his 2nd time down the aisle, seemed to be as big of a brouhaha as any infrastructure bill he'd ever brought to the Senate floor.
"That's totally fine, Suzanne," I said, Sorry about that. Don't apologize, she said. This was her idea. It's such a mess. We exchanged niceties and hung up, and I noted silently that she'd done the correct thing. Protected her client and thrown someone else, even though that someone was her client's betrothed, under the bus. I turned to Ira, who'd been listening in across the desks.
How'd that go? He said, grinning.
Well, I think you heard the sum total, I said, and we both started to laugh. Ira shook his head.
I told you he's a jerk. I can deal with it if you want.
No, no, I want to do this. It's a test, right? Ira laughed again.
Well, you let me know.
I swiveled my rickety rolling chair back to my desk and looked again at the submission Ira had given me, which he'd marked through with his signature red ink, noting the alleged facts that needed checking. It wasn't like I'd never been hung up on before by powerful people. I'd worked in Washington during the Bush years, after all, when getting yelled at and hung up on was as routine as ordering Thai for dinner. But I'd never had a receiver slam down over a matter as seemingly trivial as this. A wedding announcement. A public trumpeting of a couple's love and commitment. It wasn't a policy proposal. It was society news. I stared at the dirty taupe wall for a minute. I went to journalism school for this? And then I laughed. You bet I went to journalism school for this.
If one were to paraphrase your book, it's a book about ambitions. In some ways, it seemed to me, when I started thinking about it, that probably the two most important decisions we ever make in our lives are where we're going to work and who we're going to be partners with.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, and, you know, whether or not we're going to have kids or you know, expand your family in that way. I mean, and I definitely meant to write it as a book about ambition because it took place in a very ambitious point in my life, trying to figure out what it is I wanted in all ways, shapes, and forms. And I also wanted to point out how important it was to acknowledge what you wanted, especially as a woman, you know, and especially in the arena of marriage. Where, of course, you know, gender expectations have been so fraught and yet so cemented for decades, if not centuries. But the people I talked to were ambitious, and I think their ambitions sort of matched my own in just in different ways. And even having your wedding announcement in the Times, I think, is a signal of ambition. To feel like that this is something that, A, you wanted, and B, you know, we had many brides and grooms say, imply that this is something that they deserved. Which was always very interesting and I would say also off-putting to me.
I can relate. Did you get this sense? Yeah. I did anyway. I got this sense that at least some of these people, they were more interested in getting the announcement in the paper than they were actually getting married. And they seem to have a very skewed idea of what it means to marry somebody, you know?
It is. I mean, I think that one of the things I wanted readers, particularly from this book, other than you know having hopefully had a good time reading it, was that the day after your wedding is really the most important one because that's the one that you're in it. You're in the marriage, you know, for better or for worse. Like this is it, and that's far more important. And I think that obviously that's a very hard perspective to have unless you've been in it for a long time or for a little bit anyway. But often these brides and grooms were not the people who actually wanted their announcements in the paper. It was, you know, quite often like the bride's mother or the groom's mother. It was more important to them than it was to the bride and groom. You know, in fact, I had one bride whose grandmother sent in her wedding announcement because bride's grandmother was a New York socialite and she was incredibly connected. And to her, of course, you had your wedding announcement in the New York Times. But her granddaughter, who was a lovely, I'm assuming kindergarten teacher was clearly doing this for her grandmother. And she was far more focused on other things, for sure.
Thank you for talking about this being so much a woman's thing. I hesitate to say that because it seemed remarkably sexist, but I don't know. That was one of the abiding impressions the book left me with was this. So much of this is designed by women and organized by women, and these blokes so oftentimes just seem to be kind of a bit player in their own story. I'm sure that's not necessarily true, but it certainly sort of felt that way. Oh, and the other thing that, before I lose it, the other thing that kept going through my mind after I started thinking about the book was Charles and Diana. In some ways, that's sort of the quintessential wedding of the type that you're talking about, right? You know?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah. What specifically about them? Were you just thinking about the whole fairy tale in general?
And one of the refreshing things about your book is that you are enamored of the fairy tale, as we all are. I mean, that's why we get married, right? It's an idealized notion. And then, as you say, you know, the next day, I guess we're going to make this work now. That's when it starts. And you go from there, you know?
Yeah.
You know, and then I think, you know, some of these people, especially the people you describe who have these announcements in the Times, you think, wow, what's the next day like for them, the day after they get married, you know?
I had one bride call me from, I mean, you know, let's be truthful here, but I had one bride call me from the Caribbean island where she was, where she and her husband got married, and she had found out the day of the wedding that her husband had been having an affair with one of her bridesmaids.
I know it. I couldn't believe it when I read that. It's like, oh my God, does that happen very often? I mean, because I sort of have this sense that you have an inside track on how you know, how people treat each other.
I can say truthfully that I only heard one of those stories, and I can also say truthfully that one of those stories was really enough. You know, and it was just I remember when that happened. I was telling a friend later. I was so angry for that bride, like on that bride's behalf, even though I didn't really know her. You know, like we'd have some good conversations over the course of writing her wedding announcement, but she had called to ask if the Times would take down her wedding announcement off the site, and I said, "No, we don't do that because they're treated as a news article. You know, they're not just public notices." And if we had taken it down, that would have meant the Times was saying that, oh, the wedding didn't happen. Well, obviously, the wedding didn't happen. It did happen. It was a statement of fact. It had happened to me that the wedding happened under extremely sad and unfortunate circumstances. But, I was able to gain insight into how people treat each other and how people think the couple of weeks before their weddings, which is just, you know, those couple of weeks are just so crazy and so full of emotion and uncertainty. I think even if you are absolutely certain that this is the person you want to spend the rest of your life with, even though you think you know that, there's no knowing what's on the horizon for a marriage, obviously. You know, there's no knowing that the joys and the sadnesses and the everyday roteness of a marriage until you've lived it for a while. And I think that was one of the reasons why I waited so long to write this book, you know, because I'm thankful and grateful to be in what I think is a pretty good marriage. But it hasn't come without its challenges, certainly, not after 11 years. And I think that I needed that perspective in order to write a book about commitment, if that makes sense.
Well, I think you are perhaps, if not unique, you're in a fairly singular group of people who, the first time they kind of sort of had a romantic encounter with her husband, he was naked on stage. I don't think that happens in too many people's lives.
No, I don't think that it did. And in fact, a couple of friends of mine who have been reading this book, I've heard from a few of them, who have said, he was actually naked? And I said, yes, I told you this. But I guess that detail has slipped from their minds, but it didn't slip from mine. So, yeah. Yes, he was. He was in a play. He had gone to theater school at Florida State and had come to New York in part to be an actor with a bunch of friends. And he was in a play in the Fringe Festival that required him his first appearance on stage. He was naked. He was playing a young man with intellectual disabilities. And it took place in the bayou and the swamps. And this young man he loved running around naked in the swamps, basically. And so it was very artfully lit. You know, it's not like he just stood up there naked under some bright lights or anything, but yes, yes. And this is one reason why I don't think our daughter should read this book until she's well into her 20s.
And as you said at the time, you might at least have warned me. But he overlooked that detail, didn't he? But I think it's, you know, it's that's just one example of the way the book is structured, with this wonderful sort of counterpoint. On the one hand, you're working on the wedding announcements desk at the New York Times, and so you are sort of conjuring these would-be fairy tales in the pages of the New York Times, while at the same time, you have your own life, and that's where reality is sets in. That's where the progress of a relationship is. It's not, you know, this sort of glide into the sunset. It comes and goes. It goes up and down. It's good and bad. I love that constant juxtaposition through the book. I think it's a wonderful way of, I guess, amplifying what a weird kind of fantasy this whole announcements page stuff is so often. The things that people write and the what they want you to think. They try to manipulate you a lot, don't they?
I would certainly say that much of the weddings industry is based on total manipulation. I mean, my God, absolutely. Where would we be without the fairy tale? But I do think it's important to point out to readers and anybody, hopefully anybody who's been in a long-term, who's been lucky enough to have a long-term partnership, recognizes this in full, that marriage and relationships, long-term partnerships, are cyclical. There are ups and downs. You know, there one day you can't imagine wanting to be anywhere else, and the next day you think, I have to get out of here, I'm going to lose my mind. And of course, but you know, there's another day. You know, the sun will rise on another day, and the pendulum may be swinging the other way. But I do think that it's really important to note, and it's not because I don't want people to have these fairy tale lives or fairy tale existences or to not believe in a fairy tale, but first of all, there's no such thing, and second of all, I think the real joy is in the cyclical nature of it all and how you can rebound and how, I don't know, there's joy and happiness even when things can be really tough. And I think that's important to note for anybody going into a long-term relationship.
Yeah, I think so too. I don't think, well, maybe I shouldn't say that, but I have a feeling that many of us might not ever essay it if it weren't for the fairy tale. But the reality is so much better than the fairy tale, you know?
Probably. Yeah, I think so. I truly do. You know, this pandemic year has been incredibly difficult, and it continues to be difficult. But thank God I have such a great partner to go through it with. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as you probably know, marriage during a pandemic when you're locked down is challenging on its own. But, you know, we seem to still keep coming back to each other. And I'm, you know, more grateful for that than anything else in my life.
It seems that also while we're talking about marriages and partners, in some sense, your relationship with the newspaper is a bit like a partnership too, isn't it? And it was, again, you know, not a fairy tale perhaps, but for a young woman coming out of North Carolina to New York City and working at the New York Times, must have felt, especially when you were first starting there, as if you'd somehow landed on the top of the mountain.
Oh, 100%. I had skipped, you know, the farm leagues and gone straight up to the majors. You know, I was in the show. Absolutely. And that came with its own challenges. You know, I was missing I wasn't able to work up to the farm team. So I missed the things that I would have learned, you know, having played for the Durham Bulls before going to the Yankees or whatever. So, you know, I don't know. But you know what I mean? Like, it's good to have that training before you get to the big. But I was immediately thrown in, and so I was learning from the best right off the bat. So that was.
I don't know how it was for you, Kay, but for me, when I first arrived in New York, and the first year I spent in New York, I had serious culture shock. It's a very different culture than,
Know. Mm-hmm.
It's a very different culture from where I came from, and I suspect it probably was from where you came from too.
Yes, it was. It was, but it was a culture that I came to feel proud that I was a part of. Absolutely. And revel in, I think, and it's openness and it's acceptance of absolutely everybody, no matter the background or stripes or whatever. And, my husband certainly felt the same way as well. We both came up from small towns in the South, and I think we certainly both went through a bit of a culture shock. But I remember about 8 months after I had been in the city, everything just started to click all of a sudden. I knew where I needed to stand on the platform, on the subway platform, to get out of the right exit for the Times Square stop, to get out of the closest exit, to the Times Building. I knew which bodega to go to. I knew where in the neighborhood that had the best Lebanese takeout. I knew these things, and I was beginning to build relationships. And then, equally, I was beginning to build a relationship with the city. And I think it's a huge cliche in modern literature to talk about having a love affair with New York City. But I felt very strongly that I was in many relationships when I lived in New York, but with the city was one of the biggest and most important. And, I will say, we've been gone for 4 years, and my husband and I both still miss it every single day.
I can understand that. It's both a hugely challenging place in so many ways, because, well, not the least of which, because of so many people, but it's also a place that you have to, and again, there's these sort of parallels with you at the newspaper and you with the city. You have to learn how to navigate it. You have to learn how things work. And of course, the people who are already there take these things for granted, so they're not going to stop and explain it to you. You're going to have to figure it out for yourself. Right?
Yes, absolutely. Oh, even if it's just like, how do I get all these groceries home? Well, you shouldn't have bought that many groceries in the first place. Next time you'll know. or like, how do I buy a new Metro card? Or all of those things, all those little rituals that, you're right, everybody takes for granted, and you just have to learn it yourself.
And the pace of the place is such that there's always, at least for me anyway, I always had the sense that nobody really had the time to. And then just when I was about to just throw my hands up, some kindly soul would take pity on me and say, "Oh, you're not from here, are you? Well, let me tell you how it works."
And I think that's one of the biggest misconceptions about New Yorkers, is that they don't have time for you. I have never been treated with such kindness and such openness as when I lived, and been given such help as when I lived in New York. I mean, truly. I got to the point where, she's got people with strollers on the subway, and they've got kids hanging off of them in bags and toys and bottles and whatever else. And there was always, it was an unspoken thing that if you were standing at the bottom of a subway stairwell, and there was a person behind you with a stroller, you grab the foot of the stroller and help them carry it up the steps. That was just what you did. Mm-hmm. And I remember when I had my own child, and she was about 3 months old, and I was having a lot of wrist pain. I had to go to the doctor, and I put her in the stroller, and I went to the wrong exit of the subway. It didn't have an elevator, and I had this massive stroller, and I couldn't lift anything with my right arm because I had this wrist pain. And I just stood there at the bottom of the steps, and I almost started to cry. I was just, and it was freezing out, and I had a newborn, all of these things were swirling around. And this man walked over, and he just didn't say a word, and he picked up this really, truly enormous stroller and carried it up 3 flights of steps for me. And I think about that all the time whenever I hear somebody saying, "Oh, New York stinks," or "Why would you ever want to live there?" I mean, there's so many reasons why you would want to live there, but there's just this communal sense of, like, we're all in this together that I felt. And also, I should say that I speak from a point of exceptional privilege in many, many things. But in that moment, I felt like we were all in this together, and the entire city was behind me, no matter what.
If anybody who hasn't ever been in a subway station would have no idea of it's a Mount Olympus to get from the platform up to the street. Those steps are very steep, and frequently there's several flights of them. The other thing that one of many things that struck me in your book was your description of the workplace, Well, the New York Times, such an august institution, and the way you describe it sounds rather scruffy, at least on the wedding announcements floor. Is that true? Is that whole building
pretty,
like that?
It's pretty scruffy. It's pretty scruffy. I mean, I don't think Dean Baquet, the executive editor, would necessarily agree with that statement. But, I mean, when I was there, for sure, it was a very scruffy... I mean, look, you probably know this. The journalists are by nature pretty scrappy people. And you don't lose that just because you've made it to the New York Times. I mean, journalism is by nature a scrappy business, right? And people who choose to participate in it or who feel like they can't do anything, like they have to be journalists, they can't do anything else, are scrappers and fighters. But yes, absolutely, it's a very scrappy institution. People really weren't afraid, I think, many people weren't afraid to be their true selves there. And if that meant wearing nothing but basketball shorts to work year-round, then that's what that person was going to do. And it was because... And these sort of funky and not unusual, but sort of strange, I guess, personality traits were accepted because everybody was there to do as good a job as they could every single day. And I always felt so lucky that I was working in a place where it was so evident that that was going to be the case. You were going to walk in and work with a group of people who were A, at the top of their game, and B, working so much harder to elevate that game and by proxy, elevate the Daily Miracle that we all worked on together.
I just can't imagine how intimidating it must be when you first start at the newspaper that is known as the newspaper of record. So you're not just writing stories, you're writing history. And people are going to look at that 50 years from now and what you have written is still going to be read.
Yeah.
Could you pause?
Yeah, it's wild. And again, well, you know, every so often I'll try and find a clip of mine. I'll Google myself and kind of go down the rabbit hole, and I'll find stories that little one-off stories that I wrote when I was 23, 24 years old, cited in books because I happened to have covered, George W. Bush's presidential radio address for that morning or something. He said something. And so I'll find my names in these almost academic citations and think, oh my God, what a bizarre yet crucial thing to be able to have participated in, even and especially when writing about weddings, because you're writing about people's own intimate stories. But yes, it was deeply intimidating. But, you know, I guess I got used to it because at the end of the day, it was just a workplace. It just happened to be the New York Times, and people behave there like they behave to other places. But they just happen to be writing history.
Well, you're also expected to write to a pretty lofty standard, and that's apparent in your book. You make writing look easy. It's a beautifully written book, and it's so much fun to read. Thank you for sharing those stories.
Well, thank you for your kind words. They really do mean more to me than I can express, so thank you. And thank you for your time today. I had a really good time talking to you.
Me too. It was a pleasure to meet you, kind of, sort of. Thanks, Kate.
Thank you, Richard. Have a good one.
The book by Kate Doty, Mergers and Acquisitions, is subtitled Or Everything I Know About Love, I Learned on the Wedding Pages. On listener-supported public radio, this is Scenic Roots.
I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for listening to Scenic Roots. We come to you from WUTC at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Email us at scenicroots423@gmail.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at scenicroots423. Listen to us online anytime at WUTC.org and the WUTC app. For Richard Winham and the rest of our team, join us again next time for Scenic Roots.